exegeting Paul's back.
It's an image.
There's an image. Actually, he's just lifted up his whole totem. So what does it mean, once I was stoned? In the first century. Alright, who, well, once I was stoned, what does that mean?
Stoned,
well, dead. Alright, bingo. Capital punishment for Romans is what? Capital punishment for Jews is?
Stoned.
So Paul has basically just said here, he's just thrown this out like it's nothing, but he basically said, once I was killed. I want you to hear that. The science of torture has never been equal, much less excelled, than in a Roman crucifixion. If you saw The Passion of the Christ, it got an R rating, by the way, the largest money-making R-rated movie in history. It's a story of crucifixion. But they had to tone it down, because if they had really shown the reality of what a crucifixion was, it would have had an X rating. All crucifixions are done with the person being crucified totally naked, with all body parts and functions exposed. Because part of the crucifixion for the Romans was to kill you in every way possible, psychologically, socially, emotionally, in every way. And part of the humiliation was, over the course of many days, you lost your control of your body parts and functions, and so you were vomiting, you were urinating, you were defecating, and people laughed and had fun. That's why those three Marys and John that were so close to the cross, part of that story is they were getting what? Spray. I mean, you didn't get close to somebody crucified because of all of the splatter. It was the worst death imaginable, and the world was meant to be. And the fact is, actually, was a swear. We say, "I'm so mad at you, I could kill you." For a century, they had, "I'm so mad at you, I could crucify you." And if a chariot pulled out in front of your chariot, you yelled out, "Crucify you." Or if they couldn't hear you, you understand what these followers of Jesus did? They took the number one curse symbol.
That's awesome.
And turned it into a blessing. I mean, this is huge. Just like our taking this. No, wait a minute. And making it into a blessing symbol. Anybody want to try that? That's the power about what our ancestors did in this great cloud of ours. So the Roman form of execution, crucifixion, the Jewish form of crucifixion, stoning. Now, James already, I don't know if you heard him or not, but when I was first exegeting this, I don't know where I got this idea, but all my life, I thought that the way in which they did stonings was somebody was in the middle, you had this big circle, they had these big stones, and they threw stones at the person until they were dead. All right? Does anybody else have that idea? Okay, am I not the only one that's stupid? When you think about it, it couldn't have happened that way. Why? Because everybody's getting stoned then. Yeah. Because who's getting hit? You know, you don't have a flawless aim. So that's not how stonings took place. When the two forms of stonings for Jews was either they took you from a high point and cast you down onto the rocks below. Now, connect some dots. That sounds an awful lot like another story, which is about the temptation. See, that's basically what Satan's doing. Say, survive the stoning. Show the world you can survive execution. Or they put you in a pit. And in that pit, and this is what they did to Paul, in that pit, they would have these huge boulders. They would roll on top of you or hurl on top of you. So you are in this pit. I see, you got to use your right brain here. You got to image it. So Paul's in this pit. All right? And the stone, these huge 200-300-pound boulders are coming down on his head. What's he doing first? Give me the image. Not first. First, he's doing this. Protecting his, for as long as he possibly can. Now, you do that only for as long as you can, because after a while, what's going to happen? What's happening to your hands? Yes, they're smashed to smithereens. Okay, now connect some more dots. Why is this important?
Let's see what large letters it is.
Bingo. Describe, what did Paul do for a living? That's what he made. That's not what he did for a living. What was his trade? He was a leather worker. He sewed with his hands. Leather. Sometimes they made tents, sometimes they made other things. But that's what he made with his craft. Not what he did. So he worked with his hands. But do you ever wonder why Paul's always dictating his letters? Do you ever wonder why Paul said at the end of Ephesians, "See with what large letters I write with my own hands"? Give me an image for Paul's hands now. Yes, mangled. What else?
Twisted. Shaky.
Almost claw-like. Crabbish. You with me? I mean, just totally destroyed. So you do this for as long as you can until your hands are smashed to smithereens, and then you what? For as long as you can, you kind of go up in the fetal position. What takes the brunt of the stoning? Your back. But your whole body's broken too. Right? Now, Paul himself tells this story, or not himself. Luke tells the story of Paul. Where is it? Okay, let's look at it. Go to Acts. Connect the dots. Let's connect the dots. I think it's in, what is it, Acts 14? Is it Acts 14?
We're talking about Stephen.
No, I'm talking about Paul's stoning. Himself being stoned. I think it's, where is it? Acts 14? Yeah, there we go. Keep going down. Keep going down. Yeah, here we go. Jews came from Antioch, Iconium, and having persuaded the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing that he was dead. Now, Paul was dead. Where did he have visions of what? Now, where do you think he's having this? When does he have this? So they stoned Paul. Now, they didn't stone you until they got tired. This is capital punishment. So they stoned him. But when the disciples gathered around him, now it doesn't say how long it took. It could have been a minute, could have been a day, could have been a week, could have been a year. It doesn't matter to me. The point is, the disciples gathered around him, and this is a resurrection. Paul's not going to boast about it. He never boasts about it. He does give clues. He talks about this being caught up into the second heaven. And all those experiences, but he rose up. And did what?
Preached to God.
He rose up and did what? What city? Where he had just been stoned. Now, I don't know about you. But the last place I'm going is right back where they stoned me. But no, Paul is no dummy. Because he only goes back for what?
Christ's teachings, right?
Yeah, he only goes back in some ways to do this. You know. He only goes back for a day. Just to say, nah, you know, you thought you got me. And then he leaves. Now, I guarantee you, what I've just done with you, for the rest of your life, you will not be able to think of Paul without thinking of his back. I mean, I just have marked you for life with this story. The next time you think about Paul for the rest of your life, this is the power of an aerophore. You have been marked for the rest of your life with this story of Paul's, not just his back, but his whole body. Now, there are huge implications to this, because people go, well, Paul has a thorn in the flesh. What was his thorn in the flesh? They go, well, to see with what large letters I read, they go, he's got an eye problem. No, he doesn't have an eye problem. What was his thorn in the flesh? He's got psoriasis. Give me a break. Maybe he has diabetes. Give me a break. Paul's got every possible, imaginable physical problem you can have after 5 whippings, 2. I mean, his thorn in the flesh cannot be anything physical. I'm sorry. But, you want to hear what I think of this? This is just Len Sweet now, it's not gospel. But I would never would have come at this unless I'd done this semiotic treatment of this text. One of the things that we get really annoyed about Paul is that he's constantly, at the beginning of every single letter, asserting his apostleship. You need to listen to me, because I really am an apostle. You know what I mean? You need to listen to me. I am an apostle, and you have to listen to me. I do have authority, and that really bugs us. Because Paul is always having to assert himself and assert his authority. And we go, this guy's really got an issue with ego. I think this is Paul's story in the book. Remember what Jesus said to the disciples when he left them? Before he ascended, he said to them, stay where?
In Jerusalem.
What does stay in Jerusalem mean? If you read it, it really means don't make any decisions. Just wait until the Spirit comes and is breathing. And the disciples always do what Jesus tells them to. They are just so obedient. Disciples have a job opening. Because one of them committed suicide. Now, they all betrayed him, but one betrayed him and couldn't receive forgiveness. And so instead of waiting, the disciples decide to take the matter into their own hands and fill the job opening. And they fill it with somebody. By the way, the method that they choose to fill it is what? Gambling. They gamble to fill the 13th disciple. And they choose somebody named? And who is a very important figure in the early church, right? I mean, you hear about him everywhere. Who's a total cipher. We know something about every other disciple, even how they died. We know nothing about Matthias. In fact, there's a 6th century manuscript that says there might have been a Gospel of Matthias, but most scholars think it was another Matthias, not this one. This guy is a total cipher. See, I think Paul knows in the perfect will of God who would have been and should have been the 13th apostle. But it would have had to take place after Pentecost, because only the Spirit could have intervened to convince somebody who's already on the 12 to let Paul in. And that guy's name is Peter, who's going to want nothing to do with Paul as one of the 12. Only under, because Peter does respond to when the Spirit speaks. And I think that Paul knows, and that's his thorn in the flesh, somehow, take this from me, that everywhere I go, I got to say, I am an apostle, I am to be listened to, do I have to do it again? Take this away. See what I mean? And I never, again, that's just one sweet, that's not gospel, but I never would have come at that conclusion unless I had done this kind of semiotic work with this story. Stop thinking text, start thinking story. And even when you read Paul, there's a backstory. You're always looking for the backstory. Now, in this case, the backstory is his back. But there's always this narrow forward behind Paul. Paul is one of the greatest masters of metaphor. The very metaphor of the body of Christ is Paul's. So, comments, questions before we... See what I just did with that text? I just had you read it in a very different way. You're reading images, you're reading a backstory. Yeah?
You talked about Paul not being particularly interested in teaching with Jesus, and therefore his elongated story. Say something about the Gospel of John and not specifically the Gospels.
Yeah, well, by teachings, I'm talking about parables are narratives, they're stories. And it is Jesus' favorite method of teaching, but it's not teaching, it's storytelling. Right? And Jesus is, and that's not what, when people think about the teachings of Jesus, they're usually thinking of it. Yeah. The Sermon on the Mount. All the justice texts, especially for this culture. So, let me tell you, this is a world out there that's not clamoring for tell me the verses of Jesus. Even tell me the teachings of Jesus. They want to tell me the stories. And this is really, really important, because one of the greatest challenges of Protestantism, we began to talk about whether Protestantism has a future or not. One of the greatest challenges of Protestantism, and they're related, is that there is no longer, Protestantism is an acute identity crisis. It has no identity. And it has the worst crisis any species can have, and that is a reproduction crisis. It cannot reproduce itself. It's not reproducing itself anywhere. We are not reproducing the faith in our children. We're not reproducing the faith in our church children. And we are not reproducing the faith in the community itself. We don't evangelize. So you combine those two things together, an identity crisis and a reproduction crisis. And I think both are caused right here by this inability of Protestantism to create an identity in narrative form, but an attempt to create it in propositional form. And let me tell you what I mean by that. In other words, identity requires narrative form. Identity requires story. You cannot build a strong identity on principles, propositions, and teachings. You can only build a strong identity on narrative forms. And let me give you a couple of examples. The Amish have a 98% retention rate. Now, you heard me right. What did I say? 98%. In fact, the 2% are so unique, there's even a television show about it. About both of them. Yeah, it's called Breaking Up. There's so few of them that they even do a television show about it. Because most of the Amish don't even go through Rumspringa, and those that do go through Rumspringa, which is sow your wild oats. You know, go out, drink, you know, do everything you want to do, get it out of your system, and then decide whether or not you want to join this community again. But those who even do run spring and come back, most, except for this very small percentage. In a culture that is being preserved that is enormously different from the mainstream culture, why do Amish retain their identity and their membership in the community? Well, every Amish home from day one has three books. One book is the Bible. Second book is called Martyr's Mirror. It's about 1,000-page chronicle of the stories of the martyrs, those who were killed for their Anabaptist faith. The third book is called the Ausbund. The Ausbund is the hymn book. There are no notes in this hymn book because the melodies are passed down from generation to generation, and they are passed down at the table, which is where the Amish learn the stories of the first book. The stories of the second book, but the stories of the second book, the Martyr's Mirror, are put to musical form in the house book. So you are singing the stories of the martyrs and of the first book in that third book. You with me? So these are not really three books. They're one book, one massive narrative of which every Amish child is inducted day one, and it happens at the Amish table where they eat all three meals together. Let me try again. 7 billion people in the world. How many in the U.S.? 300 million. How many in Canada? Of 30 million. It's amazing. Canada's about the same size as the U.S. And look how we got 300 million, they got 30 million.
You're good people.
Listen, Canada right now is in a renaissance. I mean, the best music, forget Justin Bieber, but forgot it. The best novelists, the best poets, the best economy is not in the U.S., it's in Canada. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The most expensive city in the world to live in now is no longer London, it's Vancouver. I mean, yeah, Canada's in this huge renaissance. The best cheese is in Canada, for crying out loud. I mean, it makes a Swiss angry, but you guys, I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. Anybody else here from Canada? Yeah, it's unbelievable. Canada's... We had a wild, wild west. Canada right now is in the wild, wild north. Anyway, we're going to be going on. The problem is Canadians can't celebrate themselves. I mean, they really can't. You know, nothing.
Celebrate.
Anyway, except hockey. And Tim Hortons is a religion.
Yes.
It's not a good one, but that's right. So you got about 30 million in Canada. I just came from South Africa. You have about 30 million in South Africa.
Sorry.
There it is.
Sorry.
How many Jews in the world? 12 to 13 million. That's, so what's 12 to 13? Let's say 13 million of 300 million, about 7 billion. What's the percentage? You with me? It's an infinitesimally small, insignificant percentage of the total 7 billion population. You with me? Okay. Anybody want to argue that that 13 million to 7 billion has any statistical significance? Okay, let's look that aside for a minute and let's look at, give me the percentage of Nobel Prizes that have gone to Jews. How about the percentage of Oscars? How about the percentage of patents? How about the percentage of Pulitzer Prizes? We're talking about between 25 and 50% of all these major achievements for innovation, creativity, entrepreneurship, imagination. All of them, 25 to 50% are going to this statistically insignificant percentage of the world's population. So how does it happen that this half of 1% of the world's population is getting 25 to 50% of the awards and is responsible in terms of human advancement and achievement? You want to talk about the arts? You want to talk about music? You want to talk about any measure of creativity, imagination, innovation is going to this racking up? Well, they've studied this. What is the secret of Jewish achievement? And they know. Every study comes back to the same thing. And here's the same thing. Are you ready? In Jewish tradition, where is their highest and holiest ceremony? Where does it take place? In the synagogue? In the temple? In the home. And where does this these high holy ceremonies take place in the home? At the table at which they dismiss the children, correct?
No.
Protestantism, you need to hear this, at which they create their own children's worship, correct? At a table where everyone is present, all generations. And at that table, who presides? The elder, most often the father, who's the eldest. And what does he do at that table at their highest and holiest ceremony?
He asks the other child to tell a story.
Tell a story. Now, it is a religious requirement of Judaism. I want you to hear this. It's a religious, what did I say?
Requirement
of Judaism that story be seen not as something that happened in the past, but something that is happening now. In other words, you are required by the Jewish faith. When you tell the story of Moses, you tell the story of Abraham, it's not, that story is not happening to Abraham or Moses, it's happening to you. So every Jewish child from day one learns that this is their story. In other words, they have an identity that is based on a narrative. They aren't being taught verses. They aren't being taught principles. They are being taught stories. It is also a religious requirement of Judaism. Around that table, that everyone is expected to what? And how do you participate? Question the story. Because the story is strong enough to take anything you can bring it. So bring it on. Bring on your best doubts. Bring on your best questions. So from every Jewish child from day one is a required by Judaism as a religious requirement, not just to make the story their story and to see it as their story, but to bring it on. Because the story can take whatever you can bring it. So they're taught to question, to interrogate, not to be afraid of using their left brain. And so every Jewish child grows up with this narrative identity that is based on questioning and probing and pushing and all the conversations that occur around that table and about that story. So when a Jewish child reaches 13 bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah stage, and they are become part of the culture, even if they don't decide to become part of the religion, they still have an identity based on this narrative. Here's what we Protestants do. When our kids get 12, 13, we go out, okay, go find yourself. Discover who you are. Go out in the world and find out who you are. In other words, do you know the amount of imagination, creativity it takes to create your own identity? To find an identity out there for yourself? Now, I tell you, our kids are going out in the world, and we got all these 3,500 sermons a day, every one of us, which says, we've got a story for you to build your identity on. Take our story and build an identity. Well, fashion your identity on this consumeristic story. Fashion your identity on this celebrity story. And so our kids go out there in this huge, bewildering array of this maelstrom of messages that are identity forming and are told, just create an identity for yourself. These Jewish kids go out there and let's be creative. So they exercise their creativity in other arenas than trying to fashion identity for themselves, because they've got one. They've got one. It's time. We build an identity for our kids, a narrative. You say, well, isn't it kind of imperialistic to say, I'm going to shape a Jesus story and impose that Jesus story on your life? And I say, yep. You know what? When my kids are born, I didn't ask them to choose their language. You know, you're born into my household, guess what we speak? English. So guess what language you're going to learn?
French.
French. You're born into my house, guess who we serve?
Jesus.
Guess who you? Guess what narrative you're going to learn? Jesus. You're going to learn his story. It's going to be a part of who you are from day one. So this story, when we talk about the semiotics of story, what does it mean to exegete stories? What does it mean to think in stories? What does it mean to enlist this right side of our brain now? Again, it doesn't mean you repudiate the left side, because that's what happens at the table. I mean, in this Jewish table, it's unbelievable. They're getting, bringing right brain and left brain together. Interrogate the story, left brain. Learn the story, right brain. It's something that we've got to rediscover. And that's why our preaching, I'm calling for a new kind of expository preaching, a new kind of expository worship, that, but what you're expositing is an error. Lead people, just like you're never going to be able to think of Paul again without that back. You lead people with the narrow force by which to live and for which to die, countering this culture. My mother had a saying for us, and I really should do a book on this. But she said her mantra was, I have two younger brothers, they're all your parts, and we came very quick. But she sent us to the public school, but she homeschooled us in Christianity. And she did it with the mantra of, boys, I'm not going to isolate you, but I am going to insulate you. And depending on where you are, you need different padding, different R factors. And we are not insulated. You insulate with narratives. Insulate with the narratives. And until you do not insulate with words, you don't insulate with principles, you don't insulate with points. And that's been the downfall of Protestantism. And whether Protestantism can rediscover this new form of insulation for us and for our children is going to be a big issue. Comments, questions? Yeah.
Listening this morning, especially bringing up Paul, a lot of Paul's biblical summarizations in the narrative of Christ are very creedal. In the early church development, creeds were all praised. I would say that the thing that's striking to me is maybe with the exception of the Chalcedonian Creed up to that point, the creeds were very robust theologically, but they didn't. But it wasn't to the detriment of the narrative. Do you think that maybe recovering some of that is what we need to do? Or are you saying even then, that's not where we got to go? We got to go in a totally different direction.
No, I'm all for creeds. I mean, I have mantras and all sorts of stuff. But Paul's primary creed, his creed, was in was the narrative of Christ.
Absolutely.
And we've made creeds of doctrines. And the development of the church has been to more and more doctrinal formation of creeds. Paul's creeds were was a Christ creed. And especially, he died on the cross, he rose from the dead, and all that. And, yes. And beginning with the virgin birth. I mean, that's the...
Yeah, the developers have been saying, well, who is Christ? How much Christ? How much man? I understand that. But the earlier creeds, from what I've seen, are very robust theologically, but they don't detriment to the narrative, meaning Christ crucified, Pontius Pilate, that kind of thing is what I'm hearing. So I just want to make sure.
Yeah. But that's the robust theology that we're talking about.
Right.
I'm not opposed to doctrinal creeds, and I think we need them. But let me give you a couple of narrow force for them. I just came from the wine region of South Africa. I mean, some of the best wines in the world have been grown in the Cape Town area. I stayed at a winery. The amount of time they spend scaffolding those vines is unbelievable. Vines just don't grow. To get to produce the best grapes, you've got to provide some kind of scaffolding. You know what I'm talking about? There's a lot of difference in terms of, is the scaffolding best that's wire? Is the scaffolding best that's wood? Is the scaffolding more like a trellis? Some people do the scaffolding that's horizontal. All right, so there's a lot of debate among winemakers as to what's the best scaffolding. Y'all with me? But the purpose of the scaffolding is to enable the vines to grow.
Sure. Yeah.
You hear? Okay. Jesus is the vine. Now, for the vine to bear fruit, it needs some scaffolding. But you don't worship the scaffolding.
Right.
You don't praise and honor the scaffolding. You don't devote your life to the scaffolding.
See, that's what's happening.
And so we become, and we debate all the time about, you know, what is the best scaffolding? This is the better scaffolding. I got a better scaffolding than you. And you, in fact, if you don't have my scaffolding, you're not part of the winemaking business. You see what I mean? I mean? This is ridiculous. I mean, that's what the modern world did. You know, scaffolding, the technical word for scaffolding for me, and the reformers came up with this, is adiaphora. It's indifferent to your salvation. That now doesn't mean we can't differ. I mean, my brother's a Presbyterian. He's got a whole different scaffolding than I do, you know. But the point is, the scaffolding is not what feeds you. The scaffolding is not where you're going to get the fruit. I'll give you another. So let's be clear here. Doctrines are scaffolding, but the fruit is Christ. And we are now living in a culture, in a church culture, where you cannot even. Most stories have not been Christified. People are increasingly afraid to even use the word Jesus. I spent a lot of time in two areas, New York City area, a lot of bridges, Seattle, a lot of bridges, or they'll get to my house with a ferry. I go off. I can drive on a bridge. Think of the bridge that brought you all here. I can drive on a bridge 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, no problem. You with me? You don't even think about it. 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, no big deal. But let me just make one change to that bridge and see what happens. I'm going to take off the side. I'm going to take off the scaffolding. We have no barriers now. And let me tell you, that's a whole different bridge. I'm not going 60, 70 miles on that bridge. I am creeping. By the way, my disposition, I'm going to get as close to the side as I possibly can because I'm going to want to see how far away I am from tumbling off. So I'm going to want to hug the edges as I creep across that bridge. And I'm going 5, 10, 15 miles an hour because one wrong move and what? Yeah. The function of doctrines is to get you across the bridge. So you don't even know that they're there. Because this is the highway. This is the highway of heaven here. We are on a journey, and it's not to the sides. It's to the other end. But you take away the scaffolding. And so doctrine is not opposed to it. I mean, I love, but let's keep it in this. We are here to lift up Christ and Him crucified. Yeah?
Well, I'm interested to look back at what you shared about how the Jewish and Amish cultures are really home and family-based community building, identity building for their children. Yeah, we're here talking about the church and worship. How do those two relate in your mind? The family. And then what we're doing, is the weakness our Protestant worship in our culture? Is that
no, worship's got to be narrow for it. That's what I'm suggesting, is that we've got to really, as I see it, what worship does is, first of all, support what the family's doing and help to expand it. Not to replace it. But it's an extension of what goes on at that table.
And that's why, yes, it's so difficult to inject us into the worship atmosphere whenever most times it's not happening in the family.
Exactly.
I mean, that we've become, like you were talking about earlier, priest or, you know, this clergy's not a priesthood of everyone. It is, we do this for them. They bring their children. They want us to tell them all about everything. So the responsibility of the family is not. It's just not there. And so it's hard then to, you know, do this here.
But partly you, again, you prophesy your way forward here. So part of it is you expect families to do this. You give them resources so they can do this. You make it seamless, so what goes on in worship is also what goes on around the table. And you increasingly see worship as itself a table. We have read the Bible as a tablet. It needs to be read as a table. And that table, a table on which Christ is served. And that's what worship ought to be, this table of the Lord. The Lord's table on which Christ is served. First command of the Bible. I mean, let's take a bite of the whole Bible. We're going to take a bite of the apple. God's first words in the scriptures. And you be quiet. First command, the first time God speaks to Adam these words. Eat freely. Notice it's not a no. It's a yes. We've made God's first command, when you think about it, I was thinking about it, first of all, don't eat of that tree. No, that's not the first thing God says. The first thing God says, eat freely. Of all the trees, how many trees are there? Oh, about 10,000 maybe. So you got 10,000 yeses. Yes, eat of that tree. Yes, eat of that tree. Yes, eat of that tree. Eat, eat, eat. Eat freely. Eat freely of all the trees that I've given you. Eat, enjoy. Where's worship that has this kind of
yes?
Yeah. 1 Corinthians 1. Jesus is God's
amen.
Amen. God's yes. Okay. What's the last command of the Bible? Go to Revelation 22. Work your way back. Last command of the Bible as a command. Drink freely of the water of life. Bible has bookends. It's got an alpha and omega. It's got a first command and last command. And the Bible is framed with these two commands. Eat freely and drink freely. You know, everything in between is a table on which we feast on Him. The Bible is not a tablet. The Bible is a table. It's not a smorgasbord where you pick out what you like and you don't like. It's not a little snack. It's a messianic banquet, a life course meal on which we feast on Him. That feasting, that celebration, that carnal spirit, we've done cerebration. We haven't done celebration. I'm not sure we even know how to celebrate. We know how to cerebrate. Come, let's reason together. I'm not sure we know how to celebrate. Yeah.
I think the identity crisis is in the church, but it's outside the church. As they look at us, we have made it to be regulations and rules, and that's not what Christianity is about. But that's how it's moving.
Yes.
And how is that?
Exactly. I mean, you take away the parties out of the New Testament, you got very little flow. And this, to bring back, I have a book coming out called The Life Well Played, it's coming out later this year, where I'm trying to abolish the work ethic and replace it with a play ethic. God did not create us to work. You get labor and work as a result of the expulsion from the garden. But we're back in the garden. And God created, all creativity is a form of play. All creativity comes out of a play mindset, not a work mindset. And so it's time that worship ought to be seen more as play. And all that goes with that. What if you saw worship as a playground? And the whole time of worship as a playground for God's people who came to play.
It's interesting that a lot of curriculums, Bible Faith Ministries out of Minneapolis, folks for his new family. of publications is all about doing story at family at dinner. And even when it's not in the home, you know, the dinner setting in the church, the minister tells the story. It's very interesting to say that, because certainly education seems to be going back that way.
Yeah.
So if you come to us for it, we've got to get into your house.
Yeah, one of my doctoral students, Rich Melheim, really doing this, you know, for all the tribes, but especially for Lutherans. But precisely that, yeah, we're rediscovering this whole thing about narrative. But it's not just any story. You know, it's just like, you know, this is one of my problems with symbol work. You can worship. You got to be real careful. And one of the other things we worship is we worship community. You know, I'm in places where what are we celebrating? In worship, we celebrate community. No, you celebrate God in community. You hear the difference? You celebrate the body of Christ in community. But, you know, we will suddenly turn everything we touch. Calvin's right about this. We turn into an idol. And so we turn worship into an idol, and we turn community into an idol. And it's all about Christ. It's all about Christ. And you lift up Christ. So it's not just about story. One of my favorite titles is a Canadian book. And you can't copyright a title, but I honor this so much I'd never use it. But I love this. It's a title of a book. The book's all not that good, but the title is the best title I've ever. And it's a title, it's a story. The book's about the encounter of the Anglos and the Aboriginals in Canada. You call them First Nations, or... And the First Nations people. And the Native Americans, the First Nations people. And by the way, that's one of the reasons I insist on my books that U.S. America. People freak out at that. It's not just America. There are a lot of Americas. There's Latin America, South America. It's arrogant for the United States to say we are America. You got Canadian Americans. You got South Americans. You know what I mean? So we're U.S. Americans. But the First Nations people were having trouble with all these Anglos saying, no, this is our land. And the Native Americans are going, what makes it your land? We have a title to the land. Well, what's a title to the land? It's this piece of paper. So the Native Americans are going, a piece of paper entitles you to take my land? So that there's this whole culture clash here, you know? What is there about a piece of paper that enables you to take my land? It's just a piece of paper. And the Anglos are going, no, this piece of paper stands for a legal, binding investment that I own this land. And the Native is finally one chief. Couldn't take it anymore. And he just, out of frustration, he goes, so this is your land? If this is your land, tell me your stories. See, what made it, in the Native Americans' mind, their land was, it came with stories. If this is your faith, tell me your stories. If this is your Christ, how many years ago? And that's where you're going. That's where you're going. If this is your land, tell me your stories. Yeah, that's the title. If this is your land. Seldom does a whole book tell itself in a title. But there it is.
Yeah, I could change it. If this is your faith, tell me your stories.
I could, couldn't I? Yeah. But maybe. I want to end this. What are we supposed to end now? What time are we supposed to end? Okay, 12, okay. I want to end with a story, and then I want to have you watch a little video, and then we'll take lunch. But I want to tell you why I'm here today, and I want to give you a narrative for it. That I want to haunt you with four words, but you can make words into a narrative. So I'm trying to make these four words into a narrative. I'm here today because at 13 years of age, I got a call on Friday night from a pastor. His name was Dr. Leonard Snow, and he was my pastor at this Methodist church that we became part of at the age of 9, because we kept getting kicked out of the other churches. We got kicked out of the Pilgrims because my mother married this liberal Free Methodist who gave her a wedding ring, and she bobbed her hair. You know what that means? And then at age 9, I kicked out of Free Methodist Church because my father finally decided to get a television. So that's when I became a Methodist, because Methodists will take anybody. And, so, although my mother still kept raising us at, because we used to went to prayer meeting at the Pilgrim Church, and went to Sunday night service at the Free. We went to camp meetings at both of those churches. So it didn't seem to me I was losing church, I was just picking them up. But at age 9, we became part of this big Methodist church, about 2,000 people, balconies full every Sunday, about 100 in the youth group, about 100 in the choir. That kind of a Bible Belt choir where they all sat in the front, you know. It had an organ that was prominently displayed, almost like a Mormon Tabernacle organ, right in back, at a center pulpit, right in back of the pulpit was the organ. So you saw the whole organ, and the organist, the back of the organist. I got a call on Friday night from the pastor, and I was about ready to sneak out and go to a concert, and my mother called me back in and said, Leonard, phone's for you. Dr. Snow's on the phone. Now, this was not good news to me. Because one of the beauties about this church is that it had a tower and a steeple. You know, and every teenager needs a tower and a steeple. And there was a district superintendent's daughter that also had discovered. Anyway, so... So I was sure that Dr. Snow had found out about that tower and steeple. Anyway, and I was in trouble. But he got on the phone and he said, Leonard, I need to talk to you about something. And, you know, first I figured, oh, I always found out. But he goes, Leonard, we got a problem. I said, we do? He said, yeah, the church does. I said, okay. He said, Ms. Downs has eloped. Now, Ms. Downs is the organist choir director. And I said, well, good for her. And he said, well, yeah, it's good for her, but it's not good for the church, because I don't have an organist and choir director for Sunday. And I said, well, when's she coming back? He said, no, she eloped. I didn't understand this eloping stuff. I thought you eloped and then came back. But he said, oh, she's gone forever. She moved. She's gone. She's never coming back. And we have no organist choir director. And I said, well, I don't know how that has anything to do with me. And he said, well, let me tell you, I found a choir director. And I've got somebody that can direct the choir for Sunday. But I don't have an organist. And I said, well, Dr. Snow, I don't know any organist to tell you. I don't. And he said, that's why I'm calling you, Leonard. Your church needs you. I can still feel the reverberations of those four words. Your church needs you. I said to Dr. Snow, I've never played the organ in my life. He said, yeah, you play the piano. I said, Dr. Snow, the piano and organ are very different instruments. He said, yeah, but you'll learn. I said, Dr. Snow, you know, I'm used to one keyboard. That organ has four. He said, forget three of them. I said, Dr. Snow, there are these things on the floor. Yeah. He said, yeah, they're called petals. I said, I know. I wouldn't know how to do anything. He said, just forget that they're there. You just pretend that they're not there. You just got these things that you can push to make the volume go up and higher. Just use those. I said, Dr. Snow, I wouldn't even know how to turn this thing on. It's got these things you pull out. He said, yeah, they're called stops. I said, I wouldn't even know where to begin. He said, I'll meet you in the church in an hour and show you how to turn it on. You hear me, Leonard? Your church needs you. I need you. Please don't let us down. And I could not say no at the age of 13 to my pastor. So instead of going to that concert that evening, guess where I was? Guess where I spent the bulk of that night, the whole next day. At 13, I became the organist for a 2,000-member church. Because I got called out. Even though my gifts didn't match what was needed, the power of those words, your church needs you, hooked. Now, I say I'm here today because of that, because at 17, I deconverted. That's a whole other story. I became this raging atheist, Marxist. I went off on my own little journey. God is dead for 6 years. But we were very poor, and I needed money. So even in my atheist rebellion, guess where I was every Sunday? If I had not become the organist of that church at 13, I really don't think I'd be here today. Because that 6 years, I could not escape the call of the church in my life. You got 13-year-olds, so you're losing. You're losing them. And we're going to lose them forever because you are not calling them up and saying, your church needs you. Now, we don't need to play the organ so much as let me tell you what we need them to do. You saw Fernando Ortega yesterday. You heard him sing at the funeral of Ruth. I called out a teenager and said, I want to show how the incarnation works using this as a song. And I want to show how what it means to go to all the world and make disciples of all what?
Nations.
Of all cultures. That when the gospel is incarnated in a culture, it sounds different, looks different, Jesus appears different. I mean, were you all moved this morning by that Burmese? There are certain things about Jesus I will never know until the gospel is incarnated in Swahili culture, Zulu culture. I think when I image Jesus returning, it's in a Jacob's coat of all the colors. That's what it means for Jesus to achieve full stature. He's achieving full stature as he becomes incarnated in all the cultures. So give me, teenager, the help I need to make this song. Do it, the incarnational song. So here it is.
You can't have all this world.
Needs you. Let's speak them to our kids. Call them out. Have them help us. I didn't have time to do this. I mean, I helped supply some of the images and the direction and all that kind of stuff, but we need our kids. 13-year-olds, call them. All right, time for lunch.